Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano, radio and podcast producer, filling in for Cy Kellett as he and the flannel panel make their way across Rome, checking out all the cool sights and giving plenty of talks. Second hour here, open forum, joined with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. Living the dream, though it did get kind of cold the other day here in San Diego and rainy, which is...
Down to 70 degrees?
Yeah, basically, I just had to put on a sweater. Can you believe that?
You must have been freezing.
Yeah, it was freezing. I wasn't told about this when I first got the job and moved down here, so I'm a little disappointed, yeah, I got to say. So today's Thursday, which means tomorrow is a very special day where Mysterious World drops. So what's going on tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we're going to be looking at a UFO incident that occurred back in 1964. At the time, the U.S. government was testing a nuclear missile delivery system for purposes of, you know, fighting the Cold War and protecting America and so forth. And a UFO shot it down. At least that's the claim. And there was claim that this was captured on video, because they were monitoring the test of the nuclear missile system. Mm-hmm. And a UFO flew into frame and blasted the system with some kind of energy, and it failed. And this is confirmed by more than one person who was involved in the test. And so we're going to be talking about that and what it might mean in terms of UFOs having some kind of concern about humans having nukes.
Well, mystery solved. Not like we have to listen to the episode now, right?
Well, you'll have to listen to it to find out exactly what happened, and also to find out what it may or may not mean about extraterrestrial concerns about us having nukes.
All right. Well, there you go. So if you're interested, tomorrow, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops. So check that out. Well, there are plenty of people on the phones. Yeah, you want to go straight to the calls?
Sure. Why don't we go to line two?
Okay, perfect. Let's go to Logan in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Logan, go ahead with your question. Go ahead.
Hey there. I had a question, Jimmy, about purgatory. If everybody or every soul in purgatory is guaranteed to make it into heaven eventually, and mm-hmm. if we're outside of time in purgatory and in heaven, then I guess why would we even pay for the souls in purgatory to even expedite that process? And I guess I equated it to like a buffet and everybody's in line, but the buffet is guaranteed to never run out of food, and it's just a matter of when you get yours, you know? Why do we pray for it? Is it just to get it faster? But even then, we're in eternity. So I just was curious about that.
Okay, so the first thing to do is clarify our relationship with time, and we can do this up to a certain point. You often hear people say that when we leave this life, we enter eternity, and that eternity is the absence of time, and therefore that we leave time when we die. That is completely false. That is not church teaching. Where that comes from is people are aware that God is in eternity and that God is outside of time, and that we go to be with God in the afterlife, and they infer from that that we must leave time. But that is not true. God is outside of time. I can't use the word physical because it would be misleading. God is outside of time. I'm going to have to use a big word here, but I'll explain what it means. He is ontologically outside of time. Ontology is the study of what is ultimately real. And so in terms of his ultimate reality, God does not experience time passing. He is outside of time. He experiences everything in an eternal now. But that is God. We are not like that. We do experience time. Now, it may or may not function exactly like we experience it here in this life, in the afterlife, but it is actually the church's teaching that all created beings, us, the angels, everything that's created is bound by time. And so we will experience some form of time. That means that our fundamental reality is not going to go outside of time. Instead, we're going to be with God in the spiritual sense. We will be spiritually united with Him fully when we are, so to speak, in heaven. So the idea that we leave time is a mistaken notion. It's a popular mistaken notion, but it's a mistaken notion. John Paul II, for example, during his pontificate, confirmed that it's the church's understanding that all created beings are bound by time, and eternity is unique to God alone in the proper sense. Sometimes you'll hear us described as eternal beings, but what that means is we are everlasting beings. We were created at a certain point in the past, but we're going to go on forever into the future. And so we are bound by the flow of time. Like I said, it may or may not be in the afterlife exactly the way time works here, but there is an equivalent of time that we will have to go through. It's therefore possible that when we pray for those who are experiencing their final purification in purgatory, that we're asking God to help get them through that process quicker. So using your buffet analogy, it would be like you're in line for a buffet and we're praying that the line moves quickly and that they get to the food quicker. So it is possible that that could be how it works, and that in response to our prayers, God will purify souls in purgatory more quickly so that they arrive in heaven sooner. But it may not work that way because we don't know exactly how time works. Purgatory could take place instantaneously. And in that case, God would presumably apply our prayers for departed souls in another way, such as making it easier for them to get to heaven, that their purification happen not more quickly, but more smoothly, with less discomfort and with more peace and more joy and things like that. So because of our limited knowledge, which is quite limited, about exactly how the afterlife works and exactly how purgatory works, I think we have to kind of leave this as an open question of exactly what does God do in response to our prayers for souls in purgatory. It may be that he moves them through the process quicker. It may be that he moves them through the process more smoothly. It may be that he augments the process with greater joy or peace or things like that. We'll have to really leave that in God's hands, but we can be confident that since praying for the dead is a biblical practice, it's right there in the Bible in 2 Maccabees, we can be confident that God does respond in a positive way to our prayers, but we'll have to wait until we ourselves are purified to figure out exactly how God responds.
Perfect, Logan. Thank you so much for your call. This is Catholic Answers Live. You are listening to an open forum with Jimmy Akin. If you have a question, we have a line that's going to open right up. You can go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano filling in for Cy Kellett on this groovy Thursday, as Cy says it. You know, listening to him every day, I just every time I say these words, I hear his voice in my head. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they're there. So, all right. Well, lines are completely full. So let's go on. Let's go ahead and keep taking these calls. We're going to go ahead to Themel listening in Minnesota, listening on YouTube. Themel, go right ahead with your question.
Oh, hello. It is actually Themel.
Sorry, I should have put the accent on there. My apologies. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, does morality change over time? Like, some things that were morally acceptable then are not acceptable now. For example, when Jesus said an eye for an eye is no longer acceptable, even though they were taught that if it was morally acceptable at one time, does an eye for an eye in Leviticus chapter 24, verses 19 and 21, then in Matthew 5, chapter 5, 38, verse 48, is no longer morally okay? It seems as if morality is changing. Also, Jesus tells people, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. But in the Old Testament, they did live by the sword because there was many wars and killings. So it seems like morality is changing.
Okay, so I understand how one might have that impression, but ultimately what's the fundamental principles of morality do not change. They are principles that are written into human nature, and human nature does not change. So the fundamental principles of morality do not change. What can change are two things. The first one is the application of those principles, because there are different circumstances that we find ourselves in over the course of time. For example, one of the requirements in the Law of Moses is that when you build a house, you need to build guardrails around the roof of the house, or a barrier of some kind around the roof of the house. And the reason for that is people in ancient Israel used the roof of their house as kind of like their family room. They would go up on the top of the house, and they'd hang out there. They'd sometimes sleep there because it could be cooler than sleeping in the house, you know, exposed to the open air. You may note that in Acts chapter 10, for example, when Peter is waiting for lunch to get made, he goes up on the roof of the house. And so because ancient Israelites spent so much time up on the roof of their house, and they had flat roofs, not peaked roofs the way we do, but because they spent so much time on the roofs of their houses, there would be a risk of falling off if you didn't have a barrier around the roof of the house. You know, if you could just walk right up to the edge and there was no barrier there, then splat, you could fall off and hurt yourself. So because we don't spend time on the roofs of our houses in the same way, we don't have to build a barrier around the roof. But the same principle, the underlying principle of morality, that we need to take reasonable safety precautions, well, that's still true. So, for example, today, if you have, let's say, a skyscraper that has a roof garden and people are going to go up in the roof garden, well, then you do need to build a barrier around the roof of the skyscraper so that people don't fall off. Or similarly, if you have a swimming pool and people might, you know, accidentally run and fall into the swimming pool, you probably want a barrier of some kind around the swimming pool so people don't accidentally fall in and hurt themselves and possibly drown. So even though the specific commandment about building a rail around the roof of your house no longer applies, the underlying principle of we need to take proper safety precautions to protect human life, that does apply. It just gets applied in new ways because of the differences in how we build structures today. The other thing that can change over the course of time is our appreciation or perception of the rules of morality. And to give an example of this, Jesus himself cites an instance where the perception of morality did change. You had many Jewish people who believed that divorce was okay, and there was a debate in first century Judaism about, can a man divorce his wife for only certain reasons, or can he divorce her for basically any reason? And Jesus says, actually, he can't divorce her, period. It was God's will to create permanent marriages between husband and wife. That's why he made God. That's why God made Adam and Eve. He didn't provide a backup in case Adam wasn't happy with Eve. He didn't make Adam and Eve and Barbara. So according to Jesus, it was always God's will for divorce not to happen. But Jesus says, Moses nevertheless allowed you, the Jewish people, to divorce and write a bill of divorcement because your hearts were hard, because you didn't have a proper appreciation of the rules of morality. But now that I'm here, I'm telling you what God really wants. So Jesus indicated that God was willing to tolerate the evil of divorce among the Israelites because of how hard their hearts were, but now he's calling them to what God really does want. And so once again, it wasn't a rule of morality that changed. Jesus says divorce was always wrong. It's just that God previously tolerated it because of the hardness of their hearts. And so over the course of time, including the message that Jesus gave, people's perception of divorce and its evil changed. So in terms of the example you cite, we do have statements in Leviticus that say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and so forth. But then we have Jesus saying, okay, don't do this. Well, how do we square these two things? Well, one thing that's often pointed out is this law of retribution, as it's known. The fancy term for it is the lex talionis, but that just means the law of retribution. The law of retribution is basically trying to have the punishment fit the crime. So if you have knocked out somebody's eye and they are deprived of an eye, well, what would the equivalent of that be? Well, you would suffer an equivalent harm if you lost your eye. And similarly, if you knock out somebody's tooth, well, you would suffer an equivalent harm if someone knocked out your tooth. And what this principle is trying to do is make sure that the punishment fits the crime in a societal setting. This is as opposed to inflicting massive retaliation, because in the ancient world, they frequently did not. They were not concerned with the punishment fitting the crime. They would say, okay, you knocked out somebody's tooth, we're going to kill you. Or you knocked out somebody's eye, we're going to kill you. And that's an excessive retaliation. So a key part of what the law of retaliation is trying to do is limit the punishment so that it does not exceed the crime. But what Jesus is doing is something else. He's not talking about how to run a criminal justice system, which is really what the first passage is about. It's not directed to us as individuals and say, you get to knock out somebody's eye. It's the punishment that the ancient Israelite criminal justice system would have inflicted and what it's okay for that criminal justice system to inflict. But Jesus is not talking to the leaders of a criminal justice system. He's talking to us as individuals, and he's correcting a misapplication of the law from the Old Testament. He says, you know, we shouldn't, as individuals, take retaliation on our shoulders in that way. And he's exhorting us to a higher, more loving standard, but he's talking to us as individuals, not talking about what a judge and police officers and so forth would need to do in dealing with crime on a societal level. So the different passages actually do fit together. It's not a change in moral principles. In this case, it's a change of how that moral principle is interpreted and who it applies to. Jesus makes it clear that the eye for an eye principle does not apply to us as individuals, but it would still apply in a criminal justice context, not specifically about eyes and teeth, but in the sense of letting the punishment fit the crime rather than exceeding the crime.
Thamel, thank you so much for your question. We're going to move on ahead because the lines continue to be full. So we move on to David listening in Santa Rosa, listening on Facebook. David, go right ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy and the rest of the crew there. Thank you for your work. I've always wondered and never, I don't know, had the inclination to ask, but today I just felt an overwhelming sense to ask, what did it mean when Christ said, "I am the Son of Man"?
Well, this has come up a few times recently, and so I'm happy to answer it. A common proposal is that when Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, that he's referring to his humanity, because we know that Jesus is both God and man. He's the Son of God, and that's clearly a reference to his divine side. And so when he says that he's the Son of Man, it's logical to propose, if you don't know anything else, that that's a reference to his human side. And so that's been a proposal that a lot of people historically have found plausible. You can even support that by pointing out that in the book of Ezekiel, God regularly refers to the prophet Ezekiel by saying "Son of Man," and that's clearly a reference to Ezekiel being a human. So that could be taken as providing evidence that that's what Jesus is doing. When he refers to himself as the Son of God, he's emphasizing his divine nature. When he refers to himself as the Son of Man, he's emphasizing his human nature. But that's not all we know. It turns out, if you study the Jewish literature of this period, which is called the Second Temple period, because that's when the Second Temple was standing since Solomon's Temple had been destroyed, if you look at Second Temple Jewish literature, it turns out the phrase "Son of Man" took on another meaning. And that meaning seems to be rooted in Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision of God in heaven with his heavenly host, and then riding on a cloud, a figure that Daniel says was like a Son of Man is brought before God the Father. And this Son of Man-like figure is then given dominion over all peoples of the earth. And it's an everlasting dominion that will never end. And this is a heavenly figure. You know, he's riding on a cloud. Historically, that's something only in the Old Testament. That's something God does. And so this is like a divine figure. It's like a second divine figure that is being brought before the Father. And that's how it was understood by many in Judaism in this period. They would sometimes refer to this heavenly Son of Man as the second Yahweh, or as the lesser Yahweh. And so that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, "I'm that guy." He even in Mark 14, when he talks to the high priest, he says to the high priest, "I am, you know, the Messiah. And from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven." So he's saying, "I'm that guy. I'm the lesser Yahweh. I'm this divine figure." And the high priest at that point, who does not believe in the lesser Yahweh, says this is blasphemy, and he tears his clothes, and they condemn Jesus to death. So that's basically what's going on when Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. He's referring to himself not in the common sense of just saying I'm a human, but saying I'm this divine figure that rides the clouds that God gives a worldwide permanent kingdom to. And so that's, in essence, what he's referring to.
Great question. David, thank you so much for giving us that call. This is Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. If you have a question for Jimmy, we are going to have an open line here in a minute, so you can go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH. Before we go to the break here, I want to go ahead and read this ad from Carrie. Do you know what day it is? It's not just Groovy Music Thursday, but it's also Throwback Thursday. It's time to check out the Throwback Thursday extravaganza, some of the very best books ever put out by Catholic Answers. Over 50 books and ebooks to choose from, 30% off the already discounted price. Visit the Throwback Thursday catalog and shop away. When you get to the checkout, enter promo code THROWBACK, and there you go. You'll have 30% off the price of the book or any ebook from that category. So don't procrastinate. This very special offer ends at midnight tonight. What are you waiting for? Visit the Throwback Thursday category at shop.catholic.com today and let the savings begin. Your next book is waiting. I actually have a stack of them right here that will be included on that sale. So, of course, The Fathers Know Best by Jimmy Akin, The Essential Catholic Survival Guide, along with Prepare the Way, Hard Sayings, and so many other books. So make sure you check that out. Make a lot of great Christmas presents coming up, or, you know, sometimes during Thanksgiving, you need to sometimes just step away from the conversation and just give a book, because it gets a little too heated when you're talking about religion. So go ahead and visit that site, shop.catholic.com. Visit the Throwback Thursday category. And when you check out, just type in throwback and you will receive an extra 30% off from that category. Once again, open forum, Jimmy Akin. Go ahead and give us a call if you have a question at 888-318-7884.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the Feast of St. Elizabeth of Hungary and get you all the latest news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano filling in for Cy since he's making his way across Rome with the flannel panel. Meanwhile, we get to have all the fun and answer all the questions. So, Jimmy, let's go right back to the call since they're all filled up. All right. So right away, we go to William in Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. William, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you guys so much for taking my call.
Of course.
I'm in a ministry currently, and the one thing that I get question with a lot, or not so much question, but that I get approached with a lot is why experience suffering. You know, we have a lot of people who have loved ones that are suffering or loved ones that have passed away, you know, and there's always this, you know, there's always that explanation of, well, you know, things happen for a reason, but then, you know, they argue back with why do bad things happen to good people. So I just want to know if you can help me clarify that. That way I can better, you know, minister to those people who are experiencing those things.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll give you a brief answer now, but in order to really provide the kind of in-depth answer that I would need to help a person that actually is suffering, that is in the middle of this, that exceeds what I can do in a brief radio call and answer. So I'm going to recommend a couple of resources to you. The brief answer is God would not allow any evil to occur, including physical evils like suffering. He would not allow any evil to occur unless he were going to bring about an equal or greater good as a result of that evil. So nothing's going to happen that God is not going to bring about a greater good for. And that in he also, furthermore, is going to compensate everybody who suffers innocently in this life. You know, St. Paul says, he discusses this both in Romans and in 2 Corinthians, but, you know, he says the sufferings of this life aren't worth comparing to the eternal weight of glory that God has in store for us. And so no matter what we've suffered in this life, God will more than compensate us in the next life, because the sufferings of this life by nature are finite, but the joy that God will give us in the next life is infinite because it goes on for all eternity. So those are kind of the basic principles that apply here. But in order to really help someone who's in the midst of suffering and having these existential questions about why would God allow this, we need to be able to answer in more detail. And so that's why I want to recommend two resources for you. The first is a talk that I gave a number of years ago. It's called The Problem of Evil. And if you go to shop.catholic.com, you should be able to find a version of it there. I'm not sure if it's still in DVD. It may be in download, but search for The Problem of Evil by Jimmy Akin. And also this year at Catholic Answers Annual Conference, I gave a talk specifically focused on suffering. It's called If God Exists, Why Do I Suffer? And there I focus not just on the problem of evil in general, which also includes moral evil, but more specifically on the problem of suffering, which is a subset of the problem of evil. I don't think that that talk is out yet, that it's publicly available, but it's going to be becoming publicly available. And so I would suggest when it is available, and eventually, I'm anticipating it'll just be released for free on YouTube. It may be available before that for purchase, but eventually, it's going to be on the on YouTube for free. I would suggest getting that talk and watching it, because it's going to specifically deal with the subset of the problem of evil known as the problem of suffering.
William, how's that?
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate that answer.
Okay. Thank you, William. Thanks for the call. I think the talk is going to be available soon on YouTube, or I think if you're a Society 315 member, you might already have access to that. So I'll have to check up on that. But highly recommend the talk. I was there for that. So you know what, Jimmy? One thing that always comes to mind that one of my professors in college said when dealing with the problem of suffering is we're never going to receive a response that's going to be emotionally satisfying. We can give the mental satisfaction as best as we can, but emotionally we will never be satisfied.
Yeah, I don't think I agree with that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. An individual may or may not find the intellectual answer satisfying, but many people are comforted by the intellectual answer, including the realization that that we're going to be more than compensated. We're going to receive infinite joy in the next life, and our present sufferings are only finite. And while that doesn't mean that our sufferings don't hurt right now, it does mean that we can live with them, that we don't have to live with emotional dissatisfaction with the answer to this issue. So I don't think I'd agree with your professor.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I got something to chew on now for the rest of the day, so I appreciate that. All right. Sure. Well, let's go ahead and move on. We're going to stay in Texas with Ash listening on YouTube. Ash, thanks for joining us. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. This is with regards to the prophecy of Isaiah 63, verses 1-4. Has that come to pass, or should we expect that in the future? And if so, what does it mean exactly?
Okay. So anytime we have a scripture citation like this, we need to read it or summarize it for the sake of people who aren't familiar with it. In this case, I'll just read it because it's just four verses. Isaiah 63, 1 through 4 says, "Who is this that comes from Edom in crimson garments from Bozrah? He that is glorious in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength." So that's a question. The prophet sees this approaching figure and he's saying, "Who is this?" Now we get the answer. "It is I, announcing vindication, mighty to save." So this is in continuation from previous passages in Isaiah, where God's anointed one, his Messiah, his Savior, his Vindicator, is coming. And so here we have this announcement of, "It is I, announcing vindication, mighty to save." Then we have this question: "Why is your apparel red and your garments like his who treads the winepress?" Because if you tread the winepress, if you stomp on a bunch of grapes, you're going to get grape juice all over your garments. It's going to make them look red. The answer then comes, "I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. I trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. Their lifeblood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my clothing. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come." So that's the first four verses. Now, your questions about the first four verses, Ash, were what exactly?
Sorry, I wanted to know if this has come to pass yet, if this is a prophecy that needs to come to pass.
Okay. Well, prophecy often operates on multiple levels, and usually there is a near-term prophecy. There is a near-term fulfillment of a prophecy that occurred within a generation or so of the original prophet's time. But prophecy also tends to have later secondary fulfillments, such as in the time of Christ or at the end of the world. And I would have to do additional study, because it's been a while since I've looked at this text, I'd have to do additional study of situating it in Isaiah and thinking about it to say, was there a fulfillment close to the time of Isaiah, or close to the time of the return of the exiles from the Babylonian captivity? My suspicion would be, yeah, there probably was one. But what I can also say is this has been widely understood in Christian history as a prophecy of Jesus. Some of the early church fathers interpreted the blood that is on his garments as his own blood that he shed on the cross. The problem with that, though, is it's not identified as his own blood. It's identified as the blood of the enemies of Israel. And so so that's kind of a problematic interpretation. Another interpretation that would still see it as being fulfilled in Jesus is it represents Jesus in a victorious state, having conquered the enemies of God's people. So he conquered the powers of death. He conquered the power of sin. He conquered the devil. And he did that on the cross through his own blood. But here, the red stains on his garment would be representative, kind of a poetic image of the blood of death and the blood of evil and the blood of the devil, if you know the devil had blood. In other words, it's a metaphor for the destruction of the enemies of God's people in a spiritual sense. And there may yet be another future application of this, because Christ is going to triumph over the enemies of God's people again at the end of time. So I think that there may have been a fulfillment of this close to Isaiah's day, or at least the end of the Babylonian captivity. I think you can validly see this as being fulfilled in Jesus's triumph following the crucifixion. And I think that you may see another fulfillment of this at the end of the world with the definitive victory of Christ.
Ash, we're going to go ahead and leave it right there because we have to take our final break for the show today. So there are a few lines open. So if you're interested in talking to Jimmy, you can go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mind decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Mother dishes out teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers as she takes calls from her family.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live, open forum with Jimmy Akin. A couple lines still open if you want to give us a call. Give us a call at 888-318-7884. And we go to Victorville, California. Jimmy listening on YouTube. Go ahead, Jimmy, with your question.
Hi, gentlemen. Can you hear me well?
Loud and clear. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jimmy. I'm a big fan of yours. I got a quick question. It's kind of a loaded question.
Okay.
We'll finish this and hopefully you can answer. Can a pontificate ever formally teach heresy? Does formal heresy mean that a pope can reform a teaching of something that hasn't been declared infallible but is strict church teaching? For example, can the pope declare a woman can be a priest or a deaconess but be in contradiction to the positive faith, therefore it being formal heresy?
Okay, so we need to start by defining what heresy is. Heresy is the post-baptismal refusal to accept something, a dogma, and a dogma is something that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So this is not all infallible teachings, or even all, much less all church teachings. It's a subset of infallible teachings, namely those that the church has infallibly taught to be divinely revealed. So, could a pope, I want to make sure I get your question right. If I understood it correctly, it's could a pope teach something that is a heresy, meaning a rejection in this case of a doctrine that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed? Is that your question, Jimmy?
Not necessarily. I think my question mainly stems from, you know, something that the church has us want to have a religious submission of will to that is authoritatively taught, but is not infallible.
Okay, well, then we're not talking heresy at all, because heresy only concerns those things the church has taught infallibly to be divinely revealed. If it's another infallible teaching, it wouldn't be heresy. It would be very bad to contradict an infallible teaching, but it wouldn't be heresy. And if it's something that has not been taught infallibly, if it's a non-infallible teaching, then it's certainly not heresy. It's not even in the same ballpark as heresy. So if I understand your question correctly, then could a pope contradict a previous non-infallible teaching? Is that correct?
Yeah, that has us to submit to my religious faith.
Yeah, yeah, that popes can do that. That's doctrinal development, or it's at least one form of doctrinal development. Now, usually you don't get a direct contradiction. Usually what you get is a refinement of how a teaching is expressed that carries forward the same principles, but is a more refined understanding of them, so that a previous conclusion no longer follows. For example, it was part of, in the Middle Ages, there was this question of what happens if a baby dies without baptism. Well, it was recognized that, okay, baptism is the ordinary means of salvation. So it was reasoned that if a baby dies without baptism, it won't be able to go to heaven and have full union with God. But also, you don't get punished unless you're personally at fault, and babies have no personal sin. So if a baby died without baptism, it wouldn't go to heaven, but it also wouldn't be tormented in hell. And so it would go to a place, it was proposed, called limbo. This was a proposal of theologians. And they suggested maybe there's even great joy there, just not the supernatural joy of being united with God in heaven. Well, that was the speculation, and it became popular enough that for a time it was included among the non-infallible teachings of the magisterium. But over time, particularly in the 20th century, but with some precedents even earlier, other theologians said, you know, there may be other ways to account for this situation, like maybe God could provide his grace to these infants outside of the sacrament of baptism. Maybe he might count the desire of their parents to baptize them as a kind of proxy baptism of desire. Or maybe he might count the desire of the church to have them baptized as a kind of proxy baptism of desire. So maybe there are other ways besides the theory of limbo to account for what happens with these children. And by the time the Catechism of the Catholic Church was released in 1992, John Paul II was prepared to authorize the release of the Catechism, saying that we can confidently entrust the salvation of these children to God. He didn't say we know that they're being saved by God, but he said we could confidently entrust and hope for their salvation. And in the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI, the International Theological Commission, which is a kind of advisory body for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, basically said, yeah, there are other options for how God could deal with these children besides limbo. So it said you can believe in limbo if you want, but you don't have to, because there are other options. And so that represents taking something that used to be part of the common but non-infallible teaching of the church, and essentially saying you don't have to agree with this one anymore. You don't have to give religious submission of intellect and will to it, because there are other options that we've now realized in the process of thinking about this. And so you do see instances in doctrinal development where, even though the fundamental principles are still preserved, like baptism is the ordinary means of salvation, it doesn't have to be applied in the way that it was previously applied in.
Jimmy, we'll go ahead and leave it right there. I want to try to get more callers before the end of the show. So we'll move on to Thaniel listening in Pennsylvania, listening on YouTube. Thaniel, go right ahead with your question.
Thanks. Hi, Jimmy. So I hold to theistic evolution, and I read Father Ripperger's book, The Metaphysics of Evolution. And in the book, he asserts that it's untenable and irrational because it violates the priority of act to potency and the principle of economy. Do you think that theistic evolution, you know, violates these things necessarily?
No, I don't. This is an example of trying to settle matters that are fundamentally scientific on philosophical grounds. And if you look back at the history of trying to determine scientific matters on philosophical grounds, you will see lots and lots and lots of mistakes. This goes straight forward from Aristotle through Thomas Aquinas through others, prior to the development of the scientific method, which really came to flower in the 1600s. You know, they didn't have robust empirical science, which is based on observation and testing. And so they would try to kind of settle scientific questions in an armchair manner and use what seemed to them to be common sense principles. Like, for example, you would think, based on common sense, that if you have a heavy object and a light object and you drop them at the same time, the heavy object would hit the ground first. But in fact, we know that's not actually the case following the development of Isaac Newton's theory of gravity. And we've even tested that one empirically on the moon, where there's no air, so it can't cause a lighter object to float like a feather or something that has greater surface area than a lead ball. On the moon, with there no air there, if you drop a feather and a lead ball at the same time, they will hit the surface of the moon at the same time. And so I think that while it's commendable that people prior to the scientific revolution tried to solve these questions by reasoning, you know, based on what seemed to them to be sound philosophical principles, if you really want to answer questions of this nature, you can't just sit back in your armchair and smoke your pipe and think about first principles and deduce the answers with confidence. You have to look at empirical evidence and do observation and testing of a scientific nature. And when you do that, I think there's good evidence that this is a personal opinion. This is not church teaching, but I think there's good evidence that some form of evolution happened. And since God is in control of everything, that would mean that that God was in control of this process. And thus theistic evolution, I think, is a very credible theory that can't simply be ruled out on a priori philosophical grounds.
Daniel, I'm going to go ahead and leave it right there. I want to try to get one more caller on the line. So let's go ahead and jump right in with Jason in calling in Vermont, listening on the EWTN app. Jason, go right ahead with your question.
Hello, gentlemen. I'll make this quick. When a married man becomes a deacon, does he have to live a life of celibacy? And if not, is there any history to this?
Okay, so it's going to depend on what you mean by celibacy. Now, did you say a married deacon?
Yes.
Or just a deacon. Okay. A married deacon, by definition, is not celibate. Celibacy is the condition of being unmarried. So if he's already married, he's automatically not celibate. The question that I believe you have in mind is he required to be continent? Meaning, is he required to not have sex? Well, it does say in the Code of Canon Law that everyone who gets ordained is bound to continence. And if you think about that, that would seem to require a married deacon to not have sex. On the other hand, the law is not applied in that way. This appears to be an artifact of the fact that in the past, everybody who got ordained was at most a transitional deacon who would end up as a priest, and priests are bound to continence. So consequently, it is not the understanding of almost any canon lawyer that married deacons who are ordained to the permanent diaconate are required to be continent. That is not how this canon is applied in practice.
All right. Thank you very much.
Great. No problem. And if you want, Edgar, we could try Dave real quick.
All right, let's go right ahead. Dave from Cincinnati, go ahead with your question.
Hello, Jimmy.
Hi.
Around Christmas.
I need your answer. I need your question, Dave, really fast. Need it really fast.
I know. I've been through this before. You mentioned a study in Israel about people being prayed for and people not being prayed for. And I'm wondering what the results of the study are.
The results of that particular study, and you can listen to my discussion of it in the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World episode on time travel prayer, so you can Google that, is that there was some statistically significant benefit to the group that got prayed for as opposed to the other group, the control group that did not get prayed for. There have been other studies done on the same topic of prayer for people and in medical situations, and they have shown similar statistically significant benefits.
Dave, thanks for being quick. Appreciate it. Jimmy Akin, thank you so much. This was a great hour.
Thank you, Edgar.
All right. Well, we'll join you here next time. Tomorrow, we're going to have another two full hours with Jimmy, but it's going to be with Cy Kellett. It's going to be a pre-record. So tune in for that. Maybe go ahead and grab yourself a cup of coffee or wherever you are, maybe some decaf, and enjoy tomorrow's episode. And we'll see you here next time on Catholic Answers Live.